Hello, everybody. Welcome to this second Urban Age 10 global debate. I hope everyone has found a seat so far. So, welcome again. And this is the second Urban Age 10 global debate here at the LSE. We have prepared a series of 5 global debates. We had the first one last Thursday with Nick Stern, and on Wednesday we continue with the question, who owns the city, and Saskia Sassen. Hope that I will meet a lot of you again on Wednesday. Our topic today is steering urban growth, can planning and architecture manage? And I'm very delighted that we have two presenters here today who will organize, in my view, the two most important events about urbanization next year, Juan Kloss and Alejandro Aravena. The global explosion in urban populations will be accommodated largely in informal settlements. So far, no city has managed to solve the problem associated with them through new housing. The question is not only how the slums can be improved, but how the established global cities, with their massive immigration and rising inequality, might be able to find new solutions, to find new ways of participation. And here I steal from Alejandro, to find a new language of architecture for all and not just for a few. I represent the Alfred Herrhausen Society, the International Forum of Deutsche Bank. We are looking for traces of the future in the present. That means we look at current issues of our time. We enable the exchange of ideas. We bring people together who should meet. And I think you all agree that urbanization is one of the most important issues of our time. We have joined forces with the London School of Economics 10 years ago. And 5 years ago, we founded LSE Cities. So we have two possibilities to celebrate. I think happy birthday to all of us. The aim is to improve the physical and the social conditions of urban dwellers. We do research, teaching, and events, and we produce beautiful books, and not only books. Ricky asked me also to show this beautiful folder here. You all have that on your table. Also, these kind of graphics were made by LSE Cities. But we have also given the Deutsche Bank Urban Age Award 7 times to 7 different cities. This award highlights initiatives which have found their own solutions for their problems. Let it be a vertical slum in Sao Paulo, a community initiative on top of a toilet in Mumbai, or Mothers Unite in Cape Town. The award makes the invisible visible. It unveils the potential found in slums, favelas, and townships. And this is how we bring both worlds together, the experts' world from Urban Age and the grassroots world from the award. You might want to have the recipe of our successful cooperation, and I'll share that with you tonight. You have to choose the right topic at the right time, the right institutions, but most of all, the right people. Therefore, I would like to thank, first of all, the London School of Economics and Political Science for their cooperation through all these years, which made our work really productive. I'd like to thank Ricky, Philip, Richard Sennett, and the entire team, hardworking team of Urban Age, for these wonderful 10 years. And I'd also like to thank all speakers and contributors over the past 10 years for their engagement. Some of them are here today, others will join us during the week. Saskia Sassen called us once the urban tribe, but finally we have become the Urban Age family. And last but not least, I have a secret ingredient of our success. It is that we are challenging ourselves every year, again. with new topics, with new countries, with new cities, with new cultures. We step out of our comfort zone. We discussed not only architecture and planning with architects and planners, but we also discussed health issues in 2011 in Hong Kong with doctors and neuroscientists. We discussed economic growth with economists and governance with politicians. And I think that's the clue, leaving your comfort zone. I'm very happy now to introduce an Urban Age family member to you. You may have heard about José Castillo as an award-winning architect from Mexico City, as a professor of the Harvard Graduate School of Design. But for us, José is the man who organized the best city tour ever in Mexico City. He showed us all different parts of Mexico, and he even made us step into a garbage dump. And despite of this, he became a friend. José, now the floor is yours.
Thank you for such a generous introduction. Thanks, Ricky, for the invitation. My job here is basically one as timekeeper. I'll tell you a little bit about the dynamics of the event. I'll introduce the speakers and the panelists, and I'll steer the discussion in such a way that we manage to get you out of here by 8 o'clock or 8:10, and that we can have an interesting, compelling conversation. We have two fantastic speakers. We have Joan Clos, former mayor of Barcelona, and current probably the most important intellectual-manager of the future of urbanization, as head of UN Habitat and in charge of the discussion for next year's super important meeting. We are glad to hear what Joan has to say. We also have Alejandro Aravena, founder of Elemental, an architect, practicing and thinking architect in Chile, and director of the next year's Venice Architecture Biennale. And without any doubt, he has the best hair for any architect over 45. We have, we have two fantastic panelists who will answer the presentations. Beatriz Galilei is a Daniel Brodsky Associate Curator of Architecture and Design at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City. And she has also curated the Lisbon Triennale of Architecture. And she's very keen on interest in the questions of discipline of architecture and urbanism. And finally, Ricky Burdett, whom most of you know, but basically he's a Mick Jagger of urban issues. We'll have a 15 to 20 minute presentations by Joan and by Alejandro. And then we'll bring the panelists to the front, and then we'll have 10, 15 minutes for discussion. Thank you. Joan, please come on.
Thank you, José. Okay, thank you, José, for the presentation, and Ute also. It's a pleasure. It's a pleasure to be with friends of many years, and also to be here in the Cities program of the London School, talking about urbanization. As José has said, UN Habitat is the kind of global observatory of urbanization around planet Earth, of the United Nations system. And we have a conference every 20 years, and we had the first conference in 76 in Vancouver. Then we had the second conference in Istanbul in 96, and now in 2016, next year, we are going to have the third Habitat 3 conference, and it's going to be in Quito in Ecuador. And the objective of this conference is to do a critical analysis of the evaluation of the last 20 years of urbanization and some kind of prospective analysis of forthcoming urbanization in order to find out if there's any advice or any ideas that we can transmit to the national governments, which are member of the United Nations, 193 by now, members of the United Nations, out of 199 countries in the world. And also, we address our, if we are requested, we address our advice to city governments, regional governments, etc. We have done in the last 4 years quite an effort to analyze how urbanization is going on in the planet Earth lately. And the image is not very good. It's not especially good. To say the least. Urbanization is suffering quite a crisis. Even the biggest exercise of urbanization that planet Earth has seen, which has been the last Chinese urbanization in the last 30 years, the Chinese urbanization, which is a massive urbanization that has urbanized something like 500 million people, has been quite successful in terms of generating wealth, but it has been a total mistake in terms of environmental consequences, and also probably a very mixed outcome in terms of social integration. But I think that this is something that we are going to see a little bit in the presentation. I will try to follow the presentation in order not to exceed my 15 minutes. Next, please. Where is the machine? Here. It's probably here. Okay. I have titled this conference Precautionary Tools or Perhaps Tips for Good Urbanization in a Period of Rapid Urban Growth. I must say that urbanization, you know, on this graph, more or less, it's growing very much in the world. Now we are something like 3.5 billion people urbanized. But what is interesting is that in the forthcoming years, we are going to have a huge process of urbanization in Africa and in parts of Asia, which are going, it's going to urbanize 3 billion more people. That means that from now to 2050, the previsions is that we are going to double the current level of urbanization, which is a huge, figures, you know. In 1900, it was not really 1 billion. Then in 2000, 3.5 billion. And in 2050, 7 billion people, more or less. Perhaps it's going to be 6.5. But the figures are very, very relevant. This, again, is the graphic of where the growth rate and the population. You see that the browns is where the growth is higher, and it's here and here. The rest, in the developed world, we are already not growing. In fact, in the United States and Canada, there's still a little bit of growth because of the migrations. But in Europe, stagnation. In Japan, stagnation. In China, very interestingly, with the age problem, demographics, there's going to be also some kind of a stopping of urban growth. But then the rest of the world is going to urbanize in a very important manner. In the United Nations this year, in 2015, we have been approving now in September the 2015-2030 Development Agenda. You know that in the year 2000, the United Nations produced this issue that it was called the Millennium Development Goals. And the Millennium Development Goals, they were supposed to be evaluated this year, in 2015. And now in this year, we are, after evaluating the first 15 years, we are preparing for 2030. And those are the goals, which 17 goals, which were approved in New York. And I must underline goal number 11, because for the first time in the history of development, urbanization has been taken as a tool for development. That is a breakthrough, because if you talk with the development specialists, and I'm sure that there are some of you which are development specialists, they used to say that development is linked to what? Infrastructures, energy, human capital, governance, and what else? Those are the normal topics that in a list of development strategies are always listed. But for the first time, we have included urbanization. And urbanization for the sake of development. Urbanization as a tool for development, which is really a conceptual framework, a change. The role of urbanization in development, it's quite clear, but is not usually recognized, or it's not enough recognized. 80% of the total GDP is generated by urban areas. The quality of urbanization is a major driver of cities' value and productive capacity. A lot of the capacity of cities to generate value is related to the quality of their design. Urbanization then is not a passive outcome of development, is a driver of development, is a creator of development. How many of you are economists? Can you raise your hands, please? No economists in the house? In the London School of Economics, there's no... Oh, goodness. Urbanization generates a lot of value. It generates money. It's like a printing money machine, urbanization. And that should be stressed, because it's not the usual approach that sociologists, anthropologists, or urbanists, when they look at the urbanization. The usual writing about urbanization, it's about the problems of urbanization, the ailments of urbanization. Lack of housing, lack of what, lack of that, lack of the other thing, lack, you know, excess of poverty, concentration of poverty, etc. But there's not enough underlying of the value that the city generates, the urban tissue generates. And it's a lot of value. Sources of urban value. Economies of location, economies of urbanization, geographic economy. Then if you are not economist, either you already know that, or if you don't know, you go to the books and find for these topics. Then urbanization is a source of money. The London School of Economics knows that very well. Economies of agglomeration, because of specialization, because of the proximity of the factors of production, because of the diminishing cost of transaction, it generates a lot of employment. And when the economy is moving from the primary sector, extractive, agriculture, and mining, to the secondary sector, industry, to the tertiary sector, services, and in the tertiary sector to the most advanced services, like knowledge economy, the role of urbanization in this process is increasing. It's not decreasing, it's increasing. Then the future society and its capacity to generate value is very much related to urbanization. And the pity is that the quality of urbanization to develop growth and prosperity is related to the quality of its design. Not every kind of urbanization produces the same output. Okay? Then the question mark is, what can I do with my urbanization in order to maximize the capacity production? Well, here is where we come with some tools or tips for urbanization, but I am going to jump up, and I am going to talk some strategies that, after learning of our many mistakes in the past advising countries and nations and cities in the world, we have learned. What we are proposing now is a national urban policy approach. Why? Because one of the first things that we have learned in our mistakes is that usually the national government is not aware of the relevance and importance of the national government in the quality of urbanization. The national government, ministers, presidents, etc., usually they think that the quality of urbanization depends only on the mayor. And if there's something, there's a problem in a city or in a cities in general, there's a problem of the mayor because it's stupid, it's lazy, it's from the opposition, whatever. But the central government doesn't have the feeling that the central government has anything to do with the quality of urbanization. And this is totally wrong. Contrary to these ideas that the mayors will run the wall, etc., the question nowadays is that the national governments are the level of governments that they establish the rules of the game. They establish the decentralization, the financing capacities of local authorities, the power capacity assigned to the mayors. Then the national government, in the current existing political circumstances, it has a very important role in the quality of the output of cities. But the issue is that most of the people in the national government, including the president and the ministers, doesn't know about that. Then we have here a kind of autism, a kind of lack of communication, of understanding what is the role of everyone. The national government established the degree of decentralization, the responsibilities over a level of a government, coordination between subnational levels, the structure of financing of the different levels of administration, determination of the public debt capacity, including, of course, cities, and urban legislation. And all that is crucial, but I can add more thing. I can say that the national policy, it's establishing the security policy of the country, which then it's very important in the city, the migration policy of the country, that then is very important on the city. Whatever you can imagine that it's done by a central government affects the quality of urbanization. Okay, I think that I can skip that. Once that being said, the other thing that we have done is to analyze what is urbanization and why urbanization has been failing so systematically in terms of producing outcomes of interest in the world in the last years. And we have come with a three-pronged approach based on three. To reach proper urbanization, we need to build three kind of legs to sustain proper urbanization. One is rules and regulations. The other is proper physical design, urban planning, and then is financial design. Unfortunately, in too many occasions, when somebody asks a consultant, a firm, or somebody to go to a city in the developing world to help the country or the mayor to improve the urbanization, usually it's master planning or urban design. But this sectorial approach is not delivering the transformative capacity in order to change the panorama of urbanization. And this is because there's not a clear understanding that urbanization at the end is a political affair. It's the outcome of different parts that intervene in the urbanization process. And the most important one because urbanization is a human creation, is the capacity to interact in the society and establish the contract, the social compact, the social pact that allows for the possibility of living together in a compact form. In a city, you have so many agendas. Everybody has an agenda, but not just individually, also collectively or corporationally or whatever. Then what is important is really to mix together the rules and regulations, the physical design, and the financial plan. And you know that in architecture, the three-legged artifacts, like this thing, is the most secure one, because even if the floor is not flat, the tripod is the best manner to guarantee the stability of an artifact. And then you can a little bit variate the length of every one of the legs. You know, to balance a four-legged table is very difficult, and you end up putting paper and whatever. But guaranteeing the stability of a tripod, it's very easy. Then this is why I have chosen this image as the idea that for proper urbanization, we need the three things. Rules and regulations. This is a photo. This is a real photo of Ouagadougou. I don't know if you can see it. Ouagadougou is a very poor city in Africa, and you see that it was a government until here, and then it changed the government. Do you see the difference of the government? Where do you prefer to live, here or here? The interesting thing is that this was the previous government, and this is the current government. That means that things can go worse. Not always necessary things go better. Rules and regulations is very important, of land regulation, regulations for the public protection of the public space, regulations of the everything, plotting regulations, building codes. There's no need to explore that, but in our analysis of urbanization, rules and regulations is the most lacking aspect of urbanization. More than design is rules and regulations. In many countries, there are too many rules. They copy developed countries' legislation. This kind of legislation, when you copy to a political local place, it's useless. And then you have plenty of lawyers who learn how to work out the regulation and to do whatever the urban developer wants to do. Okay? And then there's no authority. There's no rules of the game. A lot of legislation, wrong legislation, implemented partially and just at the end, as if there were no legislation. Urban design. Well, for me, I need to explain a little bit for that. For me, master planning is not urban planning. I repeat, for me, master planning is not urban planning. Okay? For me, urban planning is that. The essence of urbanization is the proper design of public space. And second, the provision of well-structured building plots. And that is what is the city. Master planning, zoning, codification of land, all that is not urban planning. For me, urban planning is urban planning and design, is the correlation between the design of the public space and the design of the buildable plots. And this is what constitutes the urban fabric, the addition of the public space and the buildable plots in the form of a city. Let's go back. Here, I must say that this is one of the biggest failures in urbanization in the world nowadays. There's no urban planning in many countries where they are urbanizing fast. Why? Because nobody has the sense that has the duty of providing urban planning. The local authorities, they are too weak. The investors and the developers, they are, attracted to the city by the mayor. The mayor puts a red carpet if an investor is around. And then when the investor is there, the mayor gives to the investor a big plot and to say, do whatever, but please invest in my city. And nobody cares about urban design. And if you don't have urban design, you will not be surprised if you find African cities or Asian cities that even they are very poor, they became congested immediately. Because we have measured the public space in a city, and the public space in a planet city for streets alone, it usually is around 30%, but in the emerging spontaneous urbanization of the poor countries' urbanization, the public space is around 10%. That means that there's a huge lack of provision of public space and its connectivity. Financial plan. If there's no financial plan to sustain the cost of urbanization, urbanization decays and the city in itself decays. This is the third leg of the process. And at national level, we propose national urban policies, as I said before. At local level, at city level, we propose planet city extensions. Planet city extensions has disappeared of the history of urbanization. It's not in fashion anymore. What is in fashion is urban projects, but not planet city extensions. And as the urbanization is going very fast, we need to have big extensions, like the ones in these cities that I'm showing here, where to take in the huge growth of urban population for the coming years. There's no way that a weak city can plan the fabric of the urbanization project by project. Key for planet city extensions, an efficient street pattern, a clear and well-defined public space, in sufficient quantity, and adequate subdivisions enable different typologies of buildings and functions. And I draw the image of the planet city extension in a big scale, because only with big extensions you can alter, for example, the land market of the city. Because doing small projects, project per project, you keep this irrationality of the prices in cities, where even in an African city, you can pay for a flat the same price or even more than in London or in New York. And this is because there's no such a provision or sufficient supply of urban planning in order to change the conditions of the market. I see the public space as the yin and yang in the Oriental traditional, in the sense that our advice is that the public space should, let's say, streets and parks, should be nearly 50% of the land of the city. 30% for the streets, 15% for open spaces, and a strict connectivity of 100 between 110 strict crossings per kilometer square, and a strict width of human scales, never more than 60-80 meters for big streets, predominant width pattern between 20 and 30 meters. 20 meters is New York, 30 meters is Washington. Never less than 18 meters of width. Because we are in the 21st century. We are not in the Roman period, where the cities were of two, the streets were of 3 meters or 2.5 meters. Parks and open space, the rest. Then the yin and yang, when you do the drawing of urban design, it converts in like that, where the dark it's 50% and the white it's 50%. Okay? You know where is that? Which city is this one? Yes, you have got it. Paris. This is L'Étoile. Well, public space streets rather than roads. Human scale, of course. Walkability instead of this. Density and compactness. A wealth production capacity of urbanization is related to the quality of design of the urban space. Precautionary density to get value in urbanization, it's around 10 to 15, at least 10 to 15 inhabitants per kilometer square. Most of the urbanization built today in the world, it's at the scale of 4,000 inhabitants per square kilometers. We are manufacturing a kind of urbanization that is not productive enough. In order to generate economies of agglomeration, by the way, economies of agglomeration, of geographic economies, was the reason why Krugman was given the Nobel Prize on economy. Okay? In order to have economies of agglomeration, we need certain level of compactness. And when we, in a city, we need certain level of compactness, we need good design. Because if we have compactness and we don't have good design, we have overcrowding. It's one reason to have architects in this world. Yeah, I am finishing. Just a second. Another problem in the developing world is that you go to the mayor and said, we need to urbanize. You should urbanize. They say, no, impossible. We don't have money. This is a fallacy. Urbanization generates money. Then you need to have a value sharing system in order to have the money needed to invest in urbanization. You don't need external money. You know, you don't need money falling from heaven to build the cities. You need a political system to share the value generated by this urbanization in order to invest in the cost of urbanization. Then for me, well, like land readjustment or other technologies of acquiring public space, because this is the main problem. In Nairobi, where I live, there's the percentage of land for the streets is 10%. They need to multiply by 3. And I say, why don't you acquire or why don't you do more streets? Say, no, it's very expensive because we need to expropriate it. Of course, if in order to acquire the public land you need to expropriate, in a poor country you never will have the public land. We need to find alternative means of acquiring public space. And the alternative means of acquiring public space is land readjustment, where the... Sir? Yeah, I'm finishing, yesterday. As I am a medical doctor, now I am going to just show you, you know what is this? This is a body cut in a section at this level, okay? This is the heart, and this is the two lungs, and this is a lung cancer, lung cancer. And those are the nodules of the lung cancer. Usually all that should be black. All the arrows are the metastasis of the lung cancer. And I compare that to the metastatic city when the driver of the urban growth is only the land price. People begin to invest here or here or here because the land is cheap. Instead of following the narrative of urban planning and design. Well, I am finishing. This is the last one. Okay, the tyranny of the international model of architecture. You have here four photos. One is Istanbul, the other is Mexico City, the other is Lagos, and the other is Bombay. Mumbai. Can you tell me which one of those it's, for example, I don't know, Mexico? Which one? Yeah, one because it's Mexican, eh? This is Istanbul, this is Mexico, this is Lagos, and this is Mumbai. One of the problems of the current architecture of today in making cities is the lack of culture, the lack of personality, the lack of identity, and the market orientation of whatever is done in the cities. There is not really a focus on what is needed for the population. It's kind of upper class, you know, or this in Lagos. Imagine this in Lagos. I know, it's just, it's a joke. It's a joke. It's a joke of bad taste. And this is my last. This is my last advice to all of you. Urbanization doesn't come from heaven. Is a human creation, is a design creation, which is legal design, physical design, and financial design, and it comes by choice, not by chance. Thank you.
So, glad to be here. I arrived yesterday in Heathrow, and the immigration officer asked me, why are you here? What are you coming for? And I said, well, I'm coming to the London School of Economics for a lecture. And you are an architect? Yes. What does economy have to do with architecture? I wish he was here tonight, because if I'm able to show if there's any relationship, I might be able to explain if architecture and planning will be able to manage to steer urban growth. And I'm going to use the next 15 minutes to show that eventually the clues and keys for planning and architecture to do so is in the voids, in the bones, and in the lots of cities. So let me start with a short story that might explain this, as not just an anecdote. I started studying architecture in the mid-80s in Chile, the last 5 years of Pinochet era. And despite individually you had to take a position against or in favor, the majority, of course, against, the school I studied in introduced me in the kind of sacred laws and the integrity, artistic integrity of modern architecture. Simultaneously, we were trained for how to translate those sacred laws into reality. So it was a mixture between fundamentalism and pragmatism, what I got as an education, as an architect. That education allowed me to do buildings, mainly institutional buildings, actually just one, which is my first building, the mathematics faculty in 1998, which allowed me to be invited to Harvard to teach. So when I arrived at Harvard, I found a complete different universe of policymakers, lawyers, economists, engineers, and I didn't know a word of the language they were talking about. And more worrying is that when I tried to talk about what I was being trained in, these laws of form, they didn't get what I was talking either. I was lucky enough to find the translator, actually two translators. One, a transport engineer that was studying his master's at the Kennedy School of Government in public policy, Andres Iacobelli, who said, well, why don't we do something with social housing? In his engineer mind, do something meant a company and build according to the market laws. In my architect's mind, do something meant a book, a seminar, an exhibition. So we went, because of him, to the company. So I found myself in these meetings. And the second translator I mentioned, that even though I was not able to speak the language, over time I was able to understand the language. The second translator was form making, design. If anything, if there's any power in design, is the power of synthesis. So all these discourses that were linear, through architecture, allowed to be synthesized in a simultaneous proposal on paper at the time. Well, I still do paper, not many computers, but anyhow. So because of that capacity of design to translate forces that are outside architecture into form, we were able to move forward and do social housing. And actually, this is the first project we did back in 2003. The point, we had actually just two points while doing social housing. The first one is that when there's no money, and evidence showed that a middle-class family could live reasonably well in around 80 square meters, because there's no money, and this is the case for the majority of the world, what the market does is two things, displace and reduce. So what can be built in average in the world is around 40 square meters, and the market interprets that as a small house. So the only thing that we did was, okay, if 80 square meters is the target, but we can only build 40, what if instead of doing small houses, we do half of a good house? This, in other words, is incremental housing. So when you don't have enough money, focus on what's more difficult first and allow over time people to take over, in this case, channel their capacity to build. This is not new, it exists since the 70s, but maybe the only new thing was not even half of a house. Many times when I'm interviewed, the journalists say, well, the guys are doing half of a house. No, we're doing half of a good house. So the question is, what does it mean good? And eventually we have to redefine what is good or quality design. When you frame the problem as half of a good house instead of the small one, the key question is, which half do we do? And the definition of a public policy, that's what I got from my former partner, is that let's do the half that a family won't be able to do individually. And we identified five design conditions that belong to that difficult half. That was one point. The second point, which is connected to what I just said, redefine what is good, is that in average, what we understand by good design or a decent housing project was, well, let's make them as big as possible, try them to build and as good as possible, and let's try to make them beautiful. And we replace these three B's by just one V. A good design is the one in which a housing unit gains value over time. So it should be the opposite of a car, that every day goes down in value, and by definition, a house should grow its value over time, which what we understood is by it's an investment. We identified five design conditions that, interestingly enough, the same five design conditions that a family cannot modify or do on their own. If we did so, then housing, which is a huge amount of money being transferred from the public good, from a public money into a family asset, at least in property-oriented policies, which is the case for the developing world, then housing may be an investment and not just a social expense. And in that case, a tool against poverty and not just a shelter against the environment. So with these two points, we went to build our first project. And because the economy proved to be right, families were kept where they had their jobs and their networks, they began the process of completing the second half and to achieve a middle-class standard on their own right away. Encouraged by the fact that we were able to show photographs and not renderings. If it's not built, it doesn't count. And that's why the picture of something that was built according to the rules of the market, no exceptions. Then we tried to do many other projects, and given Chile goes the equivalent from Moscow to Mumbai, we were able to test very different geographic conditions. And eventually this has the potential to be a case study for many places in the world, which allow them to build in Mexico, for example. Or the last project we did after the earthquake and tsunami in Chile in 2010, where the scheme of half of a good house is actually very literal. But we found out that, okay, if the houses were not good, the city around was not in much better shape. So let's try to move beyond to tackle public space, infrastructure, transportation. The problem that we encountered is that when we, even though we had access to people in the position of power, even to the president or ministers or mayors, or people with money, whenever you wanted to explain, and this is exactly connected to what John Kloss was saying, there was, why should I care about the city? I mean, I'm worried about difficult issues, important issues. Not the city was not the case. So in 2006, I happened to go to the Venice Biennale, the very last day, and somebody said, look, go because there's an interesting show. Had no idea what they were talking about. It was Rodet's Biennale. And actually, the numbers that were there, I took out my sketchbook and began to write, not to draw, to write, which gave me a different language, the capacity to establish a dialogue with decision makers. A year after, it was this kind of thing. As soon as something is in the economies, then the decision makers and these in places like Chile say, well, maybe this thing matters. So we were able to enter in meetings, at least with an agreement that it was important to deal with this kind of issues. The importance that we were trying to communicate is that the cities and these exhibitions or these articles and all the research that began to appear in the world, it allowed us to communicate this double condition of cities, of being magnets, so good news, the more people in cities, the better, but simultaneously being a threat if we don't do them well. We actually framed it as the 3S menace. The process of urbanization is going to happen at the speed, at the scale, and with the scarcity of means that it may become this ticking time bomb if we don't do it properly. And information like this came so that at least we could explain the relevance of the issue to decision makers, like we will need to build a 1 million people city per week with $10,000 per family. So then the challenge for decision makers began to at least make sense. If we don't solve this kind of equation, it's not that people will stop coming to cities. They will come anyhow, but they will live in very bad conditions, in informal settlements, in favelas and slums. So, what may be some clues to solve that equation of the 1 million people city per week with $10,000 per family? And here comes another very interesting moment. 6 weeks ago, I happened to be in Chile on a Skype call. On the other side of the screen, Joan Kloss, Paolo Baratta from the president of the Venice Biennale, and Burdett. I was really amazed that there will be a kind of agreement so that whatever is discussed in the Habitat 3 can arrive to architects. Otherwise, we architects just care about things that nobody else but architects care, so that the agenda is marked with relevant issues. And eventually, we may offer some examples for how to tackle the issues that were just presented in Joan Kloss' presentation. But what remained in my mind, and I guess it came in his presentation, but I actually wanted to include it not just to tell to you, actually to tell to myself and to us in the office, that not to forget about the big picture. That if you put a gun, let's say, in my head and say, okay, about this issue that is very complex, what do? We have to choose things. I would choose these three. The first one, as he just mentioned, that take care or the voids in the city, the space in between the buildings. Make it at least 50%. Design it in such a way that the black part here gain value. Fine, but anyhow, the black thing that grows in value. In other words, I mean, is the majority, he asked, who's economist? Who's an architect here? Good majority. So for architects, get the nolly right. So this is, in the end, what needs to be very upfront and very direct. Because if it's not, well, of course, you can guess, this is Manhattan. This could be any slum. So get the voids right, because the voids, the public space, are the kind of things that individual action cannot guarantee. And it's not just the quality of life, because cities are measured for what you can do in them for free. Public space then, by definition, is redistributive. I mean, you can improve quality of life if your public space is right. But in addition, depending on the form and the proportion, then the value of the black goes up or goes down. So get the nolly right. Actually, in between the black and the white in the nolly, we found something that was also very important, particularly in the housing projects, that intermediate collective space in between the public and the private, the level of association where social agreements can be maintained. This is not beyond 20, 24 families, 150 people, more or less. And this is important when the governance in the cities is not good. Going back to the issues that Klaus was saying, public, well, he mentioned in the three-leg thing, extremely important. Get the rules right, get the finance right, and get good design. This, what I'm talking is that it's just three clues, I think, maybe a clue regarding design. So the voids, the plots. Since there are not many economists, for us, reading the book of Hernando de Soto, The Mystery of Capital, and the clarity and of the definition of the private law, which is the biggest difference between the formal and the informal city, and why then value may grow or not. I don't know if mentioning de Soto here is a disaster for us. It was a huge discovery. Might be that for economists, naming Calatrava or Pelli or Vignoli, it's a good thing. I think they suck. And anyhow, so I don't know if the sort of for economists is the equivalent for Calatrava in architecture. I hope not, but for us it was very important to discover that the clarity of the private lot was crucial in the channeling, I'm talking about steering, individual capacity. And finally, the bones. By the bones, we need the infrastructure, the physical frame to channel individual performances. So that's why many years ago, and for many years, we thought it made and didn't make any sense. But thinking backwards, now we discovered again these drawings of an aqueduct house, where the infrastructure and superstructure is defining the lot, is also helping the structural growth of families. Some of the things that cannot be done individually is structure for finance scenarios. So eventually that frame may be helpful for channeling individual actions. In any case, the point was this. Slums and favelas, we believe, are part of the solution and not part of the problem. Instead of being an incapacity to provide decent shelter, it's just the contrary. Despite not having any formal aid, people are able to provide themselves with shelter. The scarcest resource there is coordination, not money. So instead of resisting that informality, if we are able to channel that enormous capacity in the right direction, then we may succeed. I don't think we're going to ever solve the 1 million people city per week with $10,000 per family unless we channel people's own capacity as part of the solution. So I guess that individual performances like this, if coordinated properly by structure, by design, actually, if this is the way to define the voids and protect them from future invasions, then eventually we may get something like this. And somehow this is the way or the clues for which I may answer the question of the immigration officer about how planning and design may steer urban growth. Thank you.
So Beatriz, Ricky, do we manage, do we design, do we steer, do we control? What do we do about growth in cities?
Well, I'm on the, as you know, sort of sitting with Alejandro over here. You know, I think that what Alejandro represents and what he discusses is a form of architectural practice that is very much a 21st century tradition and paradigm where architects are finding themselves in positions where they're dealing with the mechanisms of power of cities. And for me, it's not just about architectural practitioners or people coming out of architecture school, but it's about architects setting up NGOs, architects forming groups, lobbying governments, starting think tanks. Architectural education is leading towards, you know, thanks to courses like this at the LSE, you know, all over the world, at Harvard, at MIT, architects are sort of feeling their the positions of power that they can reach and how much influence they can have in cities. So for me, it's about architectural education and about cultural education moving towards positions of power in cities.
I mean, what was striking in these two presentations, and very much at the heart of what I think you've just said, is that in a way you've got is the issue of language, and you know, in a way, your story, your personal story of moving into the formal world of academia and needing to find a language to talk about architecture so that it was justified in the bigger context, and here we have the head of, you know, one of the world's most important sort of international institutions using a language that, frankly, most of the people who listen to you worry about, because you're talking about density, you're talking about urban space, you're talking about the quality of design in a world where that's not often used, is, I think, one of the important issues, and therefore that goes to the heart, perhaps, of something we can go back to, Jose, which is to do with education and how things are formed. But I did, in a way, want to pick up, given that Juan gave the world lecture of how to solve the problems of cities, rightly so, because you can't talk about it in a narrow way, is perhaps just pick up one or two things which seem to me totally to connect in terms of your two presentations. Klaus talked about we've lost the ability to extend the city, right? That's a very, very... That you talked about planned extensions, and the pictures he showed were of the famous plan of Cerdà in the 1850s in Barcelona. And I think in many ways, if you think of the aqueduct that you showed at the end a moment ago, or the public space that you showed in your white spaces, the question is, how do you add to it? And I think some of the thoughts that we've had, this is something shared with Richard Sennett and many others here, is the issue of also time, which comes into it, which I was curious to know what you both felt about that, because one of the biggest urgencies now is to build these number of units over a very, very short period of time, which has not been the case from the Middle Ages to the 18th century or from the 18th century to the 19th century. From the 19th century on, it's become more urgent. And perhaps we all admire the process of urban change, which is through accretion. I think that's the term, that it happens slowly, things adapt, you test them and everything else. But much of the work that you dislike, but which is what we see, those last terrifying four slides of those four cities that we can't remember, are about urban intervention through rupture, because you've got to sort of create something immediate. So I'm just curious whether the two of you from different sides feel that there is a way in which the discipline or in a way even the legal entity can do that, because I think for Beatrice and me involved in education, or at least in engaging with the public on these issues, that's one of the biggest question marks. I feel optimistic, but I'm just curious as to where that sort of discussion is going in your minds.
Hmm. No, I think that there's still time and space to do urbanism. Yes, urbanism is still alive. And perhaps not in a very good example or in all the phases of its output, but the Chinese urbanization is an example. When you have a policy, a national policy, and you have a clear direction, it's possible to do urbanism, but although I repeat that the Chinese model has some errors in the design, then the question is to do urbanism of good quality. The problem that we face in the developing world is that the decision makers, they are not aware about urbanism. They don't understand even what we are talking about. Because they understand about free market, investment, the Washington Consensus, the central bank, the Minister of Finance, the control of inflation, and I don't know what else they know. But when you say, no, but why don't you just put a straight street here, you know? And then the corner, instead of doing that, why don't you put the corner in that? They don't feel that first is their duty. In fact, they feel that it's not their duty to do so. They think that urbanization is a kind of a spontaneous thing that happens. And this is the most serious question. There's no philosophical complex issue that, you know, like the fourth dimension of time we have lost. No. It's much easier. Urbanization now is happening at $500 per capita. When a society reached $500, in the past, in the beginning of the 20th century, urbanization was happening at around $2,000 per capita. Now urbanization is happening at $500 per capita. And well, because people has more information and people want to go to the city just in case there's an opportunity there.
Yeah.
Then the number of people arriving is much bigger than the capacity of the government to plan. But this doesn't make it impossible to plan. The problem is that the decision makers, they don't know about it. They are not aware. Even they don't feel that it's their responsibility. It's a kind of total color blindness.
Joan, let me try to connect Beatrice's comments about education. And I have certain skepticism about the capacity of technical knowledge itself to produce better urbanization. Actually, John Turner, who studied a few blocks up to the north, decided in the late 50s to go to Peru to de-educate himself, called the de-learning of the architect. So I'm thinking that there's a notion of expanding the language, which is something that Alejandro and Ricky have talked about. But I'm curious whether it's one of technical knowledge, political will, or learning differently, or de-learning.
You know who planned Philadelphia?
William Penn?
You know the author of Philadelphia? It's Mr. Penn. Himself, during a night, he drew the lines of downtown Philadelphia. Then, what is important for urban planning, even now, is not the very complexity of tools or it's not a high technology. The most important thing is the political side and the political will. To introduce planning. Then if the plan is, you know, when the three commissioners in 1811, they designed Manhattan, They, you know, Manhattan was at $1,500 per capita, and the three commissioners probably they never went to Harvard. You know, and Manhattan is the most productive urban piece of the world. Then the problem that we have lost, and the education, of course, the education should be for the students and professionals, and this is why we earn our salary. But but the ones to be educated first and at most is the decision makers, because they don't have the slightest idea of what they are doing.
Alejandro, would you like to?
So try to connect the time and design in a new way that you were trying to ask. Well, I would say that we were educated in a system where control about form. It was about form making, but that form had to be controlled. I still think that it is about form. Ultimately, we still have to do forms. But maybe the new thing is that we have to deal with open system and not with closed systems. So you frame and channel forces instead of controlling the forces. That's one thing. Regarding time, what we have found in our practice, and then somehow it's our modest opinion as a conclusion from what we found on working on in the field, is two dimensions of time, compressing and stressing time, and then having a much expanded notion of time. What do I mean by this? You just said Philadelphia plant overnight. When you have crisis, when you have natural disasters, immigration crisis, you have a pressure to come up with something in much shorter times than conventional planning, that I guess it lacks the kind of tension that moment of synthesis is required. So, even though it's a cliche, the window of opportunity of crisis and disasters shouldn't be missed. Otherwise, we invent artificial ones, Olympic Games and World Cups and something to which put you a deadline, which I think is a good thing. I was last Friday in Stockholm. They receive 10,000 immigrants per week. That's a window of opportunity that you need to use to compress and stress time. So that's one thing which I think it's very important. Conventional timing, kind of multi-year kind of thing, won't make it. So it's a good thing. The counterpart of this, when you have people being responsible of many of the constructions, this open system that people will build anyhow, even if you don't want to, they will. It's a fact that they will build. If you put sit them on the table on day one, since they are going to be partly responsible and split tasks, then if they feel that they have been there in the moment where that vision was synthesized, then they might be the only ones there when authorities change. No relevant change in cities will happen in political timing. Relevant changes take place in periods of time that may be two periods or three periods. So if you had a good participatory process, but not in the cliche of the romantic hippie kind of thing. I mean, if we really split tasks and responsibilities, they may be the only guarantee of the continuity of that vision. So I guess that this other dimension of longer periods of time combined with stressing time offers a clue for this way of having successful, open, not controlled systems.
Alejandro, Baron Lafitte has a saying that goes like, making wine is easy, it's only the first 200 years that it is difficult. and in maybe cities are like that. And I'm curious whether the favelas of Rio will become the urbinos or in a few years. Beatriz, maybe your experience as curator of the Lisbon Triennale, I'm curious whether this education extends both at the level of decision makers, but also at society as large, to including more participatory processes.
In Lisbon, 2 years ago, we made me and four other curators, work together to try and demonstrate a certain plurality, a certain ways in which architects were acting in the crisis in Portugal. And many of them were connecting. They had no ways of building traditionally. There was no formal outcome. And, you know, when you were saying, what would we do with social housing? Is it a book or an exhibition? I mean, that's essentially the form of practice that was really taking place in Lisbon. And, you know, there was, for example, a young practice, Arteria, whose project was simply to document all of the empty houses in Lisbon, allocate floor plans, take photographs of them, put them online, and connect them to possible owners and developers and architects. And so, in a way, for them, architectural practice was about mobilizing resources and connecting people to systems in a similar way. And, you know, also, I lived in China and I did a Biennale, Shenzhen Biennale in China, and this was a city that was so, exponentially, extraordinarily, catapulted into the 21st century. And there we worked with people who were coming from the countryside who were there when it was like 1981 in a fishing village. And we were able to, work with them to kind of create a cultural project that was part of the Biennale there, a kind of little, urban interventions that were supposed to be temporary but were then absorbed by the local people and became permanent installations in the city. And I think that, for me, being a curator, it's not about representing past projects, but actually kind of enabling a certain agency through cultural production. So using, you guys have both are doing biennales, there are ways of doing them that really isn't just about reflection, but is really about production. And I think that's when, you can really make it sort of provide support for other architects and provide a platform for other ways of making architecture and doing architecture.
I mean, I think one of the key things, the processes you're also describing, is a process of actually engaging with what is there. And the case of Lisbon, interesting to say, that was at a time, very severe crisis, and how do you intervene in it to breathe life back into it? Or in the cases of, these mega cities that you're describing, how do you civilize them? I mean, at the heart of that approach, I think implicit in what is being said is the notion of sort of retrofitting, which is you take what is there and you try to improve it in a way with sort of minimal means. And yes, you're right that Mr. Penn designed the city overnight. That's not that interesting. What's interesting about it is that over the next 200 years it adapted. Mm. Your point about the 1811 plan is that actually New York has been able to completely transform itself. Areas that were fashion districts have become art houses, have become condos, whatever it is, but the street structures remain the same. The model for us, which is relevant, is the Georgian house in London, or places like Notting Hill, which were designed for one thing, middle-class housing at the turn of whatever, early 19th century, then became nearly squatter settlements, student housing, drug-dealing territory, and now you can't even park your BMW over your Audi because it's become so intense. What has remained the same is the urban infrastructure. And I think these are ways of actually retrofitting and working with what is there, but also understanding this issue of time, Alejandro, which I think is what matters. So just designing it overnight, so what? I mean, that's not going to work.
No, the problem is that in most of the developing world, the level of spontaneous urbanization of people arriving to the city is so high that they do the metastatic growth like the cancer put themselves whatever they can. And then if you want to resettle or replan these settlements, it becomes extremely expensive. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it becomes, in a democratic society, it becomes a huge conflict. Then this is why the relevance of making political decisions in advance or as soon as possible, it's so crucial. Mm-hmm. Because as more the decision is delayed, the problem becomes worse. Mm-hmm. This is the dramatic situation of urbanization, mm-hmm. that the politicians, the decision makers, they are absent because they don't feel as it's their duty to plan, and in fact, the spontaneous urbanization is happening at a mass scale. This is the time problem, mm-hmm. okay. that we need to change that as soon as possible.
For example, planet cities tensions in these places are becoming very difficult because there's even no land around free that you can use as a planet cities tension. Then if we don't rush, while we are talking here, 20,000 people more have squatted surroundings of megacities just in 1 hour.
There's not a small paradox that the politician is defending design and the architect is defending management in a way.
Let me make a quick comment on what you've just said. If some favelas will become urbino or not, well, if they got the NOLI right, maybe. But if what you're just saying, if that initial geometrical grid, black and white, public and private, is not right, they will never do so. But eventually, if that is right at the very beginning, they may. In the 70s, late 60s and 70s, during Allende, in Chile, there was a very interesting way to try to cope with the amount of people migrating towards cities, and the translation would be Operation Chalk. That meant that the only thing that you had were chalk to draw the grid, so you define the roads, the private lots, and not even the sewage and the water. But then if that was right, then you could keep on upgrading over time. So that incrementality, it may lead the initial slum into Urbino or Manhattan, if that initial form is all right.
There's a very nice natural experiment in urbanization, which is fantastic. Is the apartheid urbanization in South Africa? The free towns, what is the name of the places?
The townships.
They were designed with streets because the police wanted to have easy access. Mm-hmm. And then they designed these townships, but one day apartheid disappeared. It was no more apartheid. And now, if you go to South Africa, you compare these townships with the small surroundings or slums nearby Joburg. Which do you think it's better?
The townships.
Even planning done for bad purpose, if it's good, it's going to serve the purpose.
Absolutely.
At the long...
But wouldn't you say that also the right NOLI that you showed from Paris, it's also a retrofitted NOLI,
well,
by the way.
Well, in the case, it's Haussmann, yes.
I find interesting that in the kind of those moments of magnificent in Sanchez and grow the commissioner's plan, Haussmann and Cerdá, those happen at a moment where we had the most pessimism about cities. And nowadays, in probably the new golden age of urbanisms or cities, we don't have planners.
Yeah, but you know, if in 1811 the three commissioners in Manhattan, they were able to design the streets that we walk there now, why at the 21st century we cannot do the same again?
You just spent an hour telling us why.
But it's dramatic, isn't it? It's dramatic, isn't it?
Which then goes back to the education of
I guess a possible answer is because we don't trust simplicity. The more complex the problem, the more the need for the simple answer. And then, I guess, all the consultants and experts want to sell complexity.
In cities in form of a plane, like Brasilia, like if Brasilia was going to take off. You know, why is the bloody reason why a city should have a form of a plane?
And in order to make things more complex, let's open the floor for discussion. The way we're going to do it is maybe 4 or 5 questions, and we'll let the panel answer. So please be brief. Don't stretch with long commentaries. We have 10 minutes. 1, 2, 3, and 4.
The one economist.
Okay, finally.
Okay.
Can you listen to me?
Yeah. Well.
My name is Alejandro, and I
Can you stand up, Emil?
And shout a little bit because it's not much.
Thank you. Can you hold the microphone close to you? Does it make any difference? Okay. Can we change the microphone?
Can you try these words?
Run. Thank you.
So you spoke about a lot of the cities looking the same these days and all the bad parts of all the cities that we know and love. But if you want to inspire a generation of policymakers or architects or designers or anything, where would you tell us to look?
Where do you tell us, where do we tell us to look, tell them to look?
Ah, okay.
Here.
Sorry, can I get you to pause that? Hi, my question is for Alejandro. My name is Fernanda, I'm from Brazil, and I'm very interested in how can we engage people living in slums that is already built. So how can we gauge them to rebuild in one plan like at the Elemento, that they have to build the other 50%?
Wait.
For the record.
Well, I'm slightly troubled by the assumption that all problems concerning urbanism can be solved through better design. I think I want to bring the question of livelihood. The world is full of beautifully designed buildings and structures, but without proper economic means of sustenance, in fact, they actually have never been realized. So in some sense, the assumption is that we are neglecting the major problem which faces the third world cities. The second is, when we talk about planning, we assume that there is a functioning government. In a lot of cities of the third world, there are many urban areas with a complete lack of governance.
Should we take one first?
One more, and then we answer.
One more. Here.
Thank you for your sharing. I come from Hong Kong, and in Hong Kong, it's really architects, like you mentioned, a lot of the urban planning in Hong Kong is driven by money, and the government and the developers work together to develop the city in a way. And how can we convince the government that we need to work with the people and co-design and to lead to better well-being and livelihood of the people and the city for the well-being of everyone? Because not all the architects in Hong Kong are like you guys.
Okay. You want?
Yeah. Me?
Yeah.
But no, short,
problem
huh?
Is I begin, I feel exhausted.
No.
Don't
exhaust.
I'll try because I haven't spoken too much.
All the questions are good. I'll try to combine a bit inequality and engaging of people. Start with inequality. A big underlining of that. It's a major issue in the sense that, for example, take Chile. Chile at the moment is a country of $22,000 per capita a year. If you take out, we're 17 million people, so let's say 4 million families. If you take out 1,000 families, income drops to $10,000 per capita per year. So that's a embarrassing level of inequalities in a country like Chile. So if there's any agreement in the political spectrum of the country, is that we do have a problem with inequalities. What's the only thing that is being heard to correct inequalities? Redistribution of income. As if inequalities was an economical problem only. It is economical, it's social, it's racial, it's cultural. And in that sense, the assumption is to correct inequalities, better education, because if you're better educated, you can have access to a better salary, and by having a better salary, you may buy yourself a better house or a better car instead of going in public transportation that is really inefficient, and so on and so forth. But if anything, I would say that cities are a shortcut towards equality. If you identify strategically projects in the city, take public transportation, without changing income, without changing where you live, 2 hours away in the periphery, without changing anything, the quality of life that you can improve by making an efficient public transportation system, it's huge. Let's assume that people is seated on a bus. How much that cost? Compared to the other thing, it's a much more efficient way. Public space, again, if you can improve quality of life in Chile, if you want to take a decent walk, continuous walk, you can only do that if you're a member of a golf club. If you have a public space that capitalizes geography in a magnificent way, like Rio de Janeiro does with the sidewalks, for example, it's a huge way to correct inequality. So from that point of view, I would say that cities are an extremely powerful and efficient vehicle to correct inequalities, becoming a kind of a shortcut. The thing is that we may eventually need to ask people about what is the problem that it's pressing them. We had the experience in the reconstruction of the city after the earthquake, and the question was how to protect the city after a tsunami. And we were about, as a country, to answer well the wrong question. When people was asked, they said, okay, tsunami may be an issue, but the next one is going to be in 20, 25 years. But every single year we have a problem with the flooding of the rain. We do not have public space that is decent, so they may earn some money there around the forest industry, but the quality of life, it's extremely poor. The identity of the city was connected to the geography, the river, but it was privately owned. Nobody could have access to the river. So I guess if you ask and if you intend the process of participation, not as a way to get answers from the people, but as a way to identify with precision what is the question, then eventually that may give a clue so that afterwards those forces are channeled in the proper way.
Let me take the question of the second interview, the second chat. You have asked about how to train the people to design better, and about the four photos that I presented. One characteristic of common to the four photos is that there's architecture, more or less, but there's no urbanism plan. Have you looked at that? If you look at the four photos, they are in an open space. There's a building which is done with no restriction of provided by the public space. The designer was able to use the public space as they like. It's a little bit of this tendency of the international model of architecture that they take the project and instead of being forced to build like Gaudí was forced to build in a plot in a street, or the chaps in New York, they are forced to build the high rises in a plot on the street grid. They can use the land of the street as ever they occur to them. And of course, if they don't understand the logic of the public space, they can produce monsters. Then I think that it's very important first, in order to improve architecture, is to have to put architecture in a balanced way with urbanism. There's no such a thing as just a project alone. It needs to be balanced with the urbanism, the public space. The other question is how we train for good taste, because at the end it's a question of bad taste. Then, you know, how you train the people to, you know, you need to study, you need to go to the museums, you need to try to, you know, to cultivate yourself, to appreciate beauty. You know, it's not something that comes just, you know,
it requires some mental effort. It's not just doing whatever. Huh? You know, Frank Gehry's or Saha Sahid says there are no men in the world. Huh? Then, for the normals of us, we need to follow some rules and to train ourselves and try to do things with good taste. You know.
I think it's 8:05, and I promise to get you all out of here by 8:00. So I just want to thank our panelists and presenters, Alejandro, Beatriz, Ricky, Joan, fantastic conversation. Everyone, Ute, thank you, and Herhaus and Society of the Deutsche Bank, LSE Cities and Urban Age for bringing us here. On Wednesday, we have Saskia Sassen and Anthony Williams, who will be here discussing questions of who owns the city. So the questions of equity, we promise to touch upon on Wednesday. Thank you very much for coming.